Hey guys, welcome to Cracked. I'm your host, Tristina Tucker. I'm actually recording this episode at the beach because criminals don't slow down, so neither do I. Today, we have a special guest with us. My Aunt Alicia is going to be joining us today. Alicia, say hi.
Hey guys.
Let's just take a brief moment to celebrate and appreciate the fact that today marks our 10th episode. Our entire team works tirelessly to bring you guys good, quality episodes. I want to quickly thank all of our team members. Shout out to Jen for doing all of our website work and, you know, putting up with me on the show. A big thank you to Annie, our editor. She puts together all of our episodes and helps me record and set up everything. I also want to thank Grace for coming to all of our recording sessions and always lending a helping hand in whatever needs taken care of without complaints. This show could not have been done without the help of these people, so a big thank you to all you guys. In the last couple weeks, we have been so blessed by a huge increase in followers and listeners, and we really appreciate the support. So please continue to share our episodes on social media with your friends, family, neighbors, strangers. Well, don't talk to strangers, but anyone who will listen. We also have a lot of fun stuff planned in the coming weeks, so we hope you guys are just as excited as us. So, since today marks our 10th episode, we thought it fit to bring you one of our most twisted, controversial, and horrific murders yet.
I'm excited.
Me too. This case was one that I thought I knew everything about. It's one that I had heard, and it seemed pretty open and shut. But the more I researched this case, the more I realized just how wrong I was. When two little boys are found slain in their own living room, all eyes turn to the person who was supposed to love and protect them more than anyone else. But things are not always what they seem. This is the story of Darlie Routier. Now, I do want to give a quick warning to our listeners. This story is gruesome. I would not advise listening to this case if you are under the age of 13. I also advise caution to sensitive listeners. This case does deal with the disturbing death of two young children. Definitely not for the faint of heart. I know my mom will most definitely not be listening to this one for sure. Okay, I have one last announcement and then we're going to get started. This case is complicated and many people view the evidence differently. Now, I know my point of view, but I want to be sure that you guys have all of the facts before I share any of my personal thoughts with you guys. And since Alicia is here, one of us might be playing devil's advocate a little bit too. Okay, so I kind of want to lay the foundation of this family before I start to tell the story. So the Routier family consists of five members. 26-year-old Darlie Routier was the mother, and 28-year-old Darren Routier was the father. Darlie and Darren had three sons, Devin, who was six, Damon, who was five, and Drake, who was 7 months old.
All right, awesome. I'm going to have to keep that straight.
Yeah, the names in this case are very similar. Now, the Routiers were often described as a tight-knit family. Darlie was a stay-at-home mom, and she was very involved in the lives of her sons. Journalist Kathy Cruz described Darlie as, quote, a doting mother. I kind of picture this sort of soccer mom image when trying to understand Darlie.
Okay, I got it.
The Routier home was this sort of gathering place in the neighborhood for all the kids. Now, Darren owned a company that made circuit boards, and the business was actually pretty successful right off the bat. The family had just bought a new home in Rowlett, Texas. They had a nice car and a brand new boat. And Darren loved treating Darlie and the boys to this kind of like luxurious lifestyle. So the story that I'm about to tell you guys begins on June 5th of 1996. School had been out and Devin and Damon wanted to have a camp out in the living room. And as a kid, I loved doing stuff like this and building forts, especially in the summer when school's out and you feel free as a bird. So the kids brought down their pillows and blankets and begged Darlie to let them sleep downstairs. Darlie obliged, and she agreed to sleep downstairs as well. Now pay attention because this is interesting. In Darlie's statement, she says that she was having difficulty sleeping. Now this was due to the baby rolling over in his crib and waking her up. For this reason, Darlie decides that she will be the one to sleep downstairs with Devin and Damon.
Why is that interesting?
Well, you'll see. So the boys laid out their blankets and fell asleep on the floor watching TV. Now, Darren and Darlie stayed up for a while after the boys went to sleep and just discussed, you know, adult things. They talked about the car and the boat, and they also discussed Darlie's postpartum depression. You see, after having Drake, Darlie began to suffer from depression. She would get upset and worked up and would frequently cry. Now, this is a normal thing that many women suffer from, but it did understandably bother Darlie.
Yeah, I mean, that's normal, but I understand.
So they talked, and then between 12:30 and 1, Darren went upstairs and Darlie went to bed. Shortly after 2 a.m. on the 6th is when our horror story begins. Darlie awakes to Damon pressing on her shoulder, saying "Mommy," and crying. This woke her up immediately, and she sat straight up. She then says that she saw a man at her feet starting to walk away from her through the kitchen into the utility room. She said that she heard the sound of glass breaking, so she stood up and started walking to the kitchen. She sees a knife on the floor of the utility room, so she picks it up, and it is covered in blood.
Oh my gosh.
So then she went back to turn on the lights, and that's when she saw Devin lying face up, covered in blood as well. Darlie said that she screamed for Darren, and she met him at the bottom of the stairs. Now, according to Darren's statement, Darlie actually yelled Devin's name, and that's why he ran to Devin's side. But this isn't something that I focus on because it was a moment of pure fear and panic, and no one was really thinking clearly.
Yeah, I mean, the names are similar.
Yeah, that's true. But he does say that when he saw Darlie, she looked more panicked than anyone he had ever seen, and that she was just repeating Devin's name over and over and over again. So, Darlie calls 911, and I'm going to play that call in just a second. But while she does that, Darren tries to perform CPR on Devin, and blood and air just spurt out of the holes in his chest. Okay, so I want to play this call for you, and it's a little bit difficult to hear, but the transcript is on our website if you want to follow along.
911, what is your emergency? Ma'am?
Hang on, ma'am.
Unknown medical emergency, 5801 Eagle Grove.
Ma'am,
I'm trying to get an ambulance to you. Hang on a minute.
Oh my God, my babies are dying.
What's going on, ma'am? Medical emergency, 5801 Eagle Drive, box 238, Cross Street, Linda Vista, and Willowbrook. Attention 901, medical emergency. Maybe possible stabbing, 5801 Eagle Drive, box 238, Cross Street, Linda Vista, and Willowbrook. Time out, 232.
Oh my God.
80.
Oh my God.
Need units going towards 6801 Eagle Drive, 5801 Eagle Drive. The sheriff is female on the phone.
Hold on.
Ma'am, I need you to calm down and talk to me.
Twice,
Clint.
5801
Eagle. 233 Cove. Ma'am, listen to me.
Yes,
I need you to.
Oh my God.
Can you take the radio, Clint?
Yes.
Ma'am. Yeah, I need you to talk to me. Ma'am, I can't understand you. You're going to have to slow down, calm down, and talk to me. What is going on?
Somebody came in while I was sleeping. Me and my little boys were sleeping downstairs. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my
Ma'am, is there with you? Ma'am?
What?
Is there anybody in the house besides you and your children?
My husband, he just ran downstairs. He's helping me, but he's dead. Oh, my God.
Okay. Okay. How many little boys? Is it two boys?
Two of them.
Wow, that call leaves me speechless every time I listen to it. I can only imagine that was the longest 6 minutes of Darlie's life.
I'm sure.
Seeing her children bleeding out in front of her and waiting for help, I can't even think about it. Now, there's a lot to unpack in that call, but I'm going to save that information for later on in the episode. Basically, during that call, you hear Darren trying to perform CPR on Devin and him being unresponsive. You can also hear Darlie telling Damon to hold on as paramedics arrive on the scene. Darlie later says that when she was telling Damon to hold on, he actually said, quote, "Okay, mommy." And those were actually the last words that she ever heard him say.
That is so sad.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. Another important thing to note is that Darlie mentioned that she was actually injured herself. Darlie's throat had been cut, so she had this massive laceration across her throat. And she actually had several small injuries as well, but we'll talk about that later. So Devin was pronounced dead on the scene. Darlie and Damon were rushed to the hospital, but Damon did not make it, and he was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. One of the ER nurses at the hospital said that he could hear Darlie screaming before she came down the hallway, and she was just covered in blood. Darlie was rushed to surgery. She had a 9-centimeter laceration across her throat. Her injury was actually so bad that the laceration was just 2 millimeters away from hitting her carotid artery.
Wow.
Yeah, this would have killed Darlie. The only reason it didn't is because she had on a necklace. So she just barely escaped a similar fate. So the police kind of shut down the house. There's a lot of blood all over this scene. So the evidence here is just, it's overwhelming. The first thing police notice is that there is this window screen in the garage that was cut. We'll talk about this much more in depth in a bit, but just to give you an idea. There was also bloody footprints on the kitchen floor. There was broken glass. There was a bloody fingerprint. So there was just blood covering this entire house. Once Darlie was able, police came to the hospital and asked her questions. The only description she gave was a white male in dark clothes. They asked her a lot of questions about Darren, which isn't shocking considering that in a homicide with child victims, the parents are almost always suspects at first. In this case, was no exception. So, they get a statement from Darren, and his version of events all make sense, and Darlie never named him as the killer, so he's ruled out pretty much right away. Darlie and Darren were super cooperative with police, and they were totally unaware that Darlie was actually becoming a suspect in the murders. Police told the Routiers that they had hundreds of leads. They said the man who broke in had left the prints and that they found flesh under Darlie's fingernails, flesh that didn't belong to the Routiers. But just 1 week after the murders, Darlie does something. Something odd. Something strange. Darlie does the thing that puts her in her grave. So one thing that I need to mention is that Devin's birthday was just a week after he was murdered. He should have turned 7, but he met his awful fate before he got the chance. In honor of Devin turning 7, the Routiers decided to have a graveside party of sorts. Now, before this party, they had a very long prayer service where everyone cried and prayed and just mourned together. After that, they had a birthday celebration for Devin at the gravesite. All of the neighborhood kids came and they sang happy birthday to Devin. And then it happens, the event that defines this case. The Routiers have a 20-second silly string fight. They spray silly string at each other and on the grave. Alicia, I want to show you this video and I want you to tell me what you think.
Okay, let's see it. Wow. Okay, so I see her spraying silly string. And honestly, she looks happy. She looks really happy. She looks like she's having fun.
Yeah, she does. It's bizarre. It's honestly a little off-putting. Darlie was smiling and just kind of being carefree. And I heard Ashley Flowers mention this on Crime Junkie, but the way she was just kind of chomping on her gum was so aggravating. And, I mean, obviously a person isn't guilty just for chewing gum or having a silly string fight, but a lot of people took this video to see it as a mother who was not remorseful and does not miss her children. Now, the issue is that this video of the silly string fight was released to the public, but the video of the prayer service was not.
So no one saw her grieving.
Right, they only saw the silly string monster. After this event, the police brought Darlie and Darren down to the station. They were separated, and the police talked to Darren first. They actually took Darren back to the Routier home and made him walk through what happened that night. I can only imagine the emotional impact of reliving the single most traumatic experience of one's life.
Yeah, that would be really traumatizing.
Yeah. But, I mean, I see how it was helpful, though, because it allowed police to, you know, see Darren's version of events. However, things were not working out so well for Darlie. Back at the police station, Darlie was arrested for the murders of Devin and Damon. And everyone believed that Darlie truly had murdered her sons. But it wasn't out of nowhere that they did. You see, Darlie's case was quite similar to the case of a woman named Susan Smith. Susan Smith was the mother of 2 young boys, and she claimed that a black man hijacked her car and drove away with her 2 sons inside. All of South Carolina was grieving with her, and she went on the news and pleaded with her sons' captor for the return of them. Everyone was out searching and showing support to Susan Smith. And then, 9 days after this hijacking incident, the unthinkable happened. Susan Smith confessed. She confessed to rolling her car into a lake with her boys trapped inside. She had fooled everyone. She had all of South Carolina wrapped around her finger, and everyone hated her for it. So then, a year later, when Darlie's boys are killed, she has a story about an intruder breaking in and killing them, everyone's thinking, oh, great, you know, the Dallas version of Susan Smith. So it wasn't very hard for everyone to convict Darlie in their minds.
Yeah, I do see the connection, and it seems like it was really bad timing.
It was. So I want to talk some more about all the evidence in this case. It's interesting because some people believe that the evidence points to Darlie, while others believe that it points to an intruder. The police believed that the evidence did in fact point to Darlie, but they believed Darlie was the killer beforehand, so I think that they kind of pushed the evidence to point to Darlie in a way. The first thing that police do not like right away is the fact that she mentioned getting a print off the knife in the 911 call. Now the thing is that she said that after the operator told her not to touch anything. The conversation went like this. Darlie said, and there's a knife, and then the operator said, don't touch anything. Then Darlie said, I already touched it and picked it up. And then a few minutes later, she says his knife was laying over there. And then the operator says, it's okay, it's okay. And then Darlie said, God, I bet we could have gotten prints or something maybe. I don't find this incriminating at all, if I'm being 100% honest. First of all, the operator had told her not to touch anything. She didn't say, don't touch the knife. To me, that was pretty obviously pointing at something to do with evidence, because she said, don't touch anything. It wasn't like she was saying to Darlie, don't touch anything or don't touch the knife so you wouldn't cut yourself. You know, she said, don't touch anything. It was to preserve the scene as best as possible. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Well, Tristina, yeah, but no one would have thought about that in the moments after their kids were stabbed. And maybe you're right. But she also waited a few minutes before she said anything else about it, which leads me to believe that it didn't click right away. She probably had a trillion things running around in her mind, so it makes sense that for a brief second, she would be panicked that she messed something up. If we are basing a conviction off Darlie's two-second concerns for fingerprints, then there should be a lot more criminals behind bars. I mean, my true crime brain would probably have done the same thing. It doesn't make me a killer. You never know how you're going to react in a moment of trauma like this, so we really can't jump to too many conclusions based off of this evidence.
Yeah, I mean, no one really knows how they'd react, so it's hard to determine what's appropriate and what's not.
Exactly. Another thing that the police use as a nail in the coffin is Darlie's wounds. Now, I told you about Darlie's neck, but I didn't mention all of the other bruises and cuts that she had all over her entire body. Darlie had cuts across her shoulders, her arms, and even her fingers. And I mean a lot of cuts on her hands and fingers. And many specialists testify that these wounds are typical of self-defense. She had bruises on her wrists and all the way down her arm, all over her elbows. I mean, this poor girl is covered in bruises. She also has a stab wound on her right forearm, and not to mention the laceration on her neck that was 2 millimeters away from her carotid artery. Alicia, I'm going to walk you through these pictures, and I want you to kind of describe them and talk about your initial thoughts.
Okay, so I see a really bad bruise on Darlie's forearm. And it looks like a stab wound to Darlie's right forearm as well. And some wounds on her fingers and wrists. I see a picture of her after surgery. She does look pretty beaten up. Looks like she has some wounds on her neck and her shoulder and a really bad bruise on her elbow. She has some cuts on her arm. She has wounds on her left wrist. And yeah, she does look like she was putting up some self-defense.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of people point out. Now, these pictures will be on our website, but I mean, I've never seen someone so battered in this type of situation. I mean, it's crazy. Now, I couldn't believe this, and I don't know if you guys will either, but police say that Darlie's wounds are superficial.
Superficial?
Yeah, if someone can look at these pictures and say that they are superficial, then we're going to make a quick trip to the eye doctor because there is nothing superficial about her injuries. Now, one doctor said that her injuries were superficial in regards to her carotid artery, meaning she wasn't cut. Her carotid artery wasn't cut. So the police really just heard the word superficial and ran with it, which, in my opinion, is very faulty police work.
Yeah, I agree. They are writing a narrative and making the evidence support it, rather than writing a narrative based on what the evidence would support.
Correct. And there is more. Remember that cut screen in the garage?
Yeah.
Well, it is making an appearance once again. So in essence, police believe that the window was cut from the inside. Their first and biggest reason for this is because they found a rubbery compound on a knife in the kitchen that matches the fibers in the screen, leading them to believe it was cut from within the house. They also say that there was mulch under the window that was undisturbed, as well as dust on the sill of the window. Now, I want to tell you why all of that information is totally invalid. So the first thing is that the knife that was used to cut the screen, and I say that in quotations, was dusted. And it was dusted with the knife that had been used to dust the screen, meaning that the fibers that were on the screen could have very easily been transferred to the knife.
Yeah, that could definitely be cross-contamination.
Like I said, kind of faulty police work in my opinion. Another thing I want to mention is that the mulch under the window was not at all under the window. It was probably 3 to 4 feet to the right of the window. And my last thing, the window was basically sitting on the ground. I mean, it was very low, and it would have been very easy to get into that window without even touching the windowsill. Darren actually did a demonstration of him getting in and out of the window, no problem. And, like, he isn't tiny. He's an average-sized guy. So police's theory here is really not that solid. Now, another piece of evidence that is important to mention is the broken glass that Darlie heard. Now, police say Darlie was lying about everything because her blood was under the glass. Now, you can call me devil's advocate if you want. But again, there are two very solid possible explanations as to how that happened that don't convict Darlie of 2 counts of capital murder. The first one being that, the killer, after fighting and stabbing Darlie multiple times, had Darlie's blood on him. And that's how the blood was on the floor. Because remember, there is blood all over this scene. It really doesn't mean anything. The other reason is that the scene really wasn't all that well preserved by the police. So it's possible that in the shuffle of paramedics, detectives, and the routiers that the glass got moved a little bit. And when I say possible, I mean there is a very strong chance.
I think both of them seem more possible than Darlie killing her sons.
I agree. Adding to the list, another piece of evidence, and probably the most important, is this 85J fingerprint. Now, this fingerprint was left on a table in the living room. It was a bloody fingerprint, but there's one question in everyone's minds. Who does it belong to? Well, I can't answer that, but I can tell you who it doesn't belong to. It doesn't belong to Darlie. It doesn't belong to Darren. It doesn't belong to Devin or Damon. So who else would have left that print? Well, perhaps it was a killer. A killer that does not live in the Routier home.
Ooh, Tristina, I just got goosebumps.
Also, I want to mention that the knife found in the Routier home only had Darlie and Damon's blood. So it begs the question, where is the knife that killed Devin? Is it possible that there were two intruders and that they took one of the knives with them? Or maybe that there was just one intruder, but the knife broke while killing Devin and that he used a different knife on Damon and Darlie and just left that one at the scene. We don't know.
That seems like a really big deal.
It should have been, but again, in the minds of the police, the case was already solved. The last piece of evidence is one that should have cleared Darlie's name. This piece is a sock. A single adult athletic sock. It was found 75 yards from the Routier home. Down an alley, beside a trash can, hanging into a sewer drain system. A sock that had blood from not only Devin, but Damon as well. This sock is the key. How did it get here? Whose sock is it? Police believe that Darlie killed the boys and then ran 75 yards to plant the sock. Now, that's all fine and dandy except for one thing. There isn't enough time. You see, the police believed that Devin died first, and with his injuries, he would have had a maximum of 9 minutes to live. Now, what police are suggesting is that Darlie killed Devin and Damon, got the sock, and dipped it in both of their blood, ran 75 yards down an alley in nothing but a t-shirt without being seen, placed the sock by the drain, somewhere it could have very easily been missed, ran back home, inflicted her own injuries, and called 911. Here's the problem, though. Darlie's 911 call was 6 minutes, meaning she would have had 3 minutes to do everything else. I don't think 3 minutes would have been enough to inflict all of her injuries, let alone run 75 yards and back and kill Damon. And believe it or not, the timeline is not the only issue with this theory. There's also the fact that the sock could have so easily have been missed. I mean, it should have been missed. So why, if Darlie wanted to make it look like there was an intruder, did she hide the sock? Why wouldn't she place it closer to the house, where it definitely would have been seen? Speaking of being seen, you're telling me a mother, covered in blood and wearing only a t-shirt, could have run 75 yards without being seen by anyone? Yeah, okay. Well, here's my other problem. Why a sock? Why not take the knife or something off one of the boys, or that window screen? Why a sock? It doesn't make sense.
It seems like the sock was being hidden, not displayed, and if you were Darlie and you did kill the boys, you would need the sock to be displayed.
Exactly. Also, there's a map on our website so you can see how far the sock was from the home. Next up on our agenda, a lead that was not followed up. A woman named Karen Neal lived across from the Routiers. She reported seeing a black car in front of her sidewalk 7 days before the murder. She said the person in the car was staring straight at Darlie's home. She said that he was there for a while, and then when she went to approach the car, it immediately drove away. Then, if that wasn't enough, she saw the car again on the day of the murders around 12:30 p.m., so that would have been on the 5th. She called the police, but they never followed up.
This seems like a lead that could really go somewhere.
Yes, it does. And the more I researched this case, the more frustrated I became with the members of the Rowlett Police Department. And don't get me wrong, I love the police. They do incredible work. But the way this case was handled was so subpar. So Darlie's trial started in January, which meant that everyone had to work fast. And one thing I want to mention about the trial is that Darlie was only charged with Damon's murder. They did this because if they tried her with both boys' murder and lost, they couldn't try her again because it's double jeopardy. So they charged her with one so that if they lost, they could try her again for Devin's murder.
They can do that?
Yep. Now, a lot of people get upset by this and say it's not fair, but honestly, I've got to hand it to the prosecutors. It is a brilliant legal strategy. So anyway, the trial was moved to Kerrville, Texas, which is a more conservative part of Texas, and that means two things. One, they are more likely to give Darlie the death penalty, and second, they won't like Darlie's appearance at all. So when the trial started, the prosecution played to that. They talked about how Darlie wore flashy clothes, and how she bleached her hair, and how she had breast implants. Now, to me, none of that has anything to do with whether or not she is guilty. However, the prosecution used it as a total character assassination. Basically, they said that Darlie was self-centered and materialistic, therefore guilty of murder.
This case seems very weak.
Well, that's because it is. Now, the question on everyone's mind, why did she do it? Well, the motive the prosecution offers is, once again, weak. So basically, Darren's business was in a little bit of a slow period, which wasn't terribly uncommon, but it did put them in a little bit of debt. So the prosecution argued that Darlie wanted to have more money to spend on herself, so she killed the boys because they were a financial burden. But I have two problems with this. Number one, it seems to me like a baby would have been more of a financial struggle than a child, so it doesn't make sense that she would kill the kids over the baby, or at least one of the kids and a baby. It doesn't make sense. My second and biggest problem with this is that she had to pay $12,000 for her emergency surgery alone, and I'm sure she also had to pay for other medical bills and the funeral costs and all sorts of other things you don't think of when dealing with the death of two young boys. So the fact that she wanted money really doesn't make any sense to me. It's just not that strong of a motive.
I am beyond frustrated right now, Tristina.
I totally understand. Okay, I'm going to tell you now what the prosecution used as their quote-unquote bombshell. So, Darley kept this journal, and there's one entry in particular that the prosecution focused on from a month before the killings. Now, I'm going to read you the one sentence that was read in court. Quote, "Devin Damon Drake, I hope that one day you'll forgive me for what I'm about to do."
Mm-hmm.
Unquote.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It looks terrible. And they actually claim this is a confession. But here's the issue. They didn't read the whole thing. And it paints a totally different picture. So I'm going to read it for you. Darley writes, quote, "Devin Damon Drake, I hope that one day you'll forgive me for what I'm about to do. My life has been such a hard fight for a long time, and I just cannot find the strength to keep fighting anymore. I love you more than anything else in this world. I want all three of you to be happy and healthy." Unquote. That is not a confession.
No?
To me, that is a suicide note. Remember, Darley suffered severely from postpartum depression. In the months before the murder, she was very depressed and she would cry over things that may have seemed minuscule to somebody else, but were a very, very big deal to Darley. Another thing about this note that I think is very important to point out is the fact that she addressed it to Devin, she addressed it to Damon, and she addressed it to Drake.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
Why would she write a confession to someone that had no crime committed against them? It doesn't make sense. And so when it comes up that this may be a suicide note, the lead prosecutor, Greg Davis, said, and I quote, "Mothers don't normally take the life of their children, but mothers don't normally contemplate suicide either."
Excuse me?
Yes, he actually said those words in an interview. I'm not sure what possesses a man to say those words out loud, but it is absolutely 100% outrageous. Saying a mother isn't allowed to be depressed or suicidal is absurd. Mothers put up with a lot of crap, and Greg Davis needs to realize that just because someone is struggling mentally does not mean that they are capable of committing a double homicide against their children.
Exactly.
It is absolutely ridiculous, and it angers me so much to think that someone not only thought that, but said it out loud in an interview. But the thing at the trial that honestly sealed Darley's fate was that silly string video. The video was played during the court, and the jurors ultimately ended up watching that video 11 times during deliberation.
Wow.
They said they found it repulsive, and it was a little bit. She was literally dancing on their graves. But what the defense brings up during court is that the police illegally set up mics and surveillance at the gravesite during that prayer service.
What?
Yeah, apparently they were hoping that someone would confess over the grave. And when the police officers were called to the stand, they pled the fifth when they were asked about it. And if we learned anything from Mark Furman in that O.J. Simpson trial, it was that when law enforcement officers plead the fifth, it looks really bad. Another thing that shocked me, because it was such a horrible idea, was that Darley actually took the stand.
That was such a bad idea.
Yeah, well, she did well at first, but during the cross-examination, she got defensive and dismissive with the prosecution. She didn't cry. She didn't look at the jury. It, simply put, was a disaster. The jury deliberated for 7 hours before they came back with a verdict. But when they came back, they found Darley guilty of capital murder in relation to Damon's death. Darley was sentenced to death and is still sitting on death row today.
Wow, that's crazy.
And there are a lot of things that came out after the conviction that I do want to briefly mention. So first of all, buckle up, because this one's going to make you go, what? Before the murders, Darren was soliciting someone to fake a robbery on his house for an insurance scam.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Now, to me, this makes me wonder, was this whole thing a robbery gone wrong? Was this whole thing connected to Darren's idiotic scheme?
This opens up a whole nother set of questions.
Yeah, it most definitely does. Another post-conviction conversation that's been had is that the sock had chloroform on it, and it knocked Darlie out, and that's why she didn't wake up right away. Because a lot of people find it odd that she would wake up when Drake rolled over in his crib, because that's why she was sleeping on the couch, but not when her children and herself were being stabbed. So it would make sense that she was drugged and she was in and out of consciousness the whole time. Now, the sock has never been tested because this was brought up later, but it's a theory that was tossed around a lot. The other thing is that 85J fingerprint. The process of getting that tested is in the works today, but it takes time for those things to kind of pan out. Darlie and Darren got divorced in 2011. Darren says that he still loves Darlie and thinks that she's innocent, but he had to move on with his life. Okay, so I tried to tell you guys the story before giving you my stance, but I did slip in some of my thoughts throughout. I do 100% believe that Darlie is innocent. Now, defending her is a new position for me because I am a prosecutor at heart, so I wouldn't typically side with the mother in this kind of situation, but after spending 30-plus hours reading court documents, reading over all sorts of different stuff from this case, and watching interviews, there is not a doubt in my mind that Darlie is innocent. When I heard about this case on other podcasts, I always thought guilty. But after watching Darlie's body language in interviews and hearing her side of the story and looking at all the evidence, I just think that she was sincere and that the evidence points a different direction and that she was wrongly convicted.
I think she is definitely guilty.
You do?
Definitely.
I want to hear a little bit about this. What makes you think that?
Everything. I think that she is a liar. I think that she was depressed, going through emotional issues. I think that she probably had some issues with her husband. I think that she was insecure about herself and life. And I think that she went crazy and she killed her children.
You know, there's a lot of people that agree with you, but I want to ask you something that it changed my opinion of the whole case. What about all of the evidence that doesn't add up? The things that they use to convict Darlie that doesn't make sense. For example, you know, the sock. Do you think Darlie planted the sock?
I don't think that she did it, but maybe her husband did it. And I think that there's definitely probably more to this story that we haven't discussed.
So you think Darren was also involved?
I do.
Do you think that he was involved with the killing of the boys or just with, you know, planting? Like, do you think he killed the boys and Darlie was in on it? Or do you think that Darlie killed the boys and Darren helped to cover it up?
I think that he knows what happened.
You think so? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's why that they got divorced?
Yeah.
What about, you know, this other fingerprint that doesn't belong to anybody in the house?
They probably had a lot of other people in the house. He could have had a friend come over. I mean, there's so many different things that I think just aren't discussed. There's got to be more to the story.
Do you think it could have anything to do with that insurance scam that Darren set up?
Absolutely, because men are greedy.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair assumption. I don't think Darlie was involved, but I do think that your side of the story could be accurate. I think there are probably a lot of things that nobody knows. And I think that, you know, honestly, we probably might not ever find out. But there are a few things that Darlie shared with the world that I want to share with you guys. The first is a poem that Darlie wrote in memory of Devin and Damon Routier. It's titled, quote, "Mommy, We Love You." Embrace yourselves because it will make you emotional. Reading this was the first time I ever cried while researching a case. It goes, "I thought of you today, as I always do. I thought of your smile and your laughter too. Your little hand pressed gently in mine, no hurry or rush, no pressing of time. I thought I would hold you forever, but God took you home to his kingdom in heaven. There are so many words I never got to say, so many games and silly things we never got to play. I saw the rainbow, not just one, but two. I knew it was a gift from your brother and you. My heart longs for you, and I cry out in pain. Nothing in my life will ever be the same. Come to me, babies, in my dreams so true. I need to hear your magic words. Mommy, we love you." Those boys were so young and so beautiful, and they were ripped from their mother's loving arms far too soon. I can only imagine the pain and the heartache and the emptiness one would feel. It's unbearable. Another important thing I want to read to you guys is a letter that Darlie wrote to her supporters. This letter is dated December 9th, 2007. She reads, It doesn't seem possible that it's been 11 and a half years since this nightmare began. I close my eyes, and it seems like just yesterday the boys were racing outside to play with their friends, so innocent, so alive, and so very precious. My mind plays back like an old home movie, first steps, and birthday parties. I have so many memories, each more precious than the next. At times, they are my salvation, and other times, my undoing. Yet even when the pain is the greatest, I force myself to feel it. It reminds me what this is all about. My pain is intimate and deep, a pain I'm not sure I could even comprehend had it not been forced upon me. There have been times I've simply wanted to say no more, to just give up. It has been during these times that I have felt each of you holding me up. I realize more and more each day that I'm not fighting this battle alone. With each tiny step, you are holding me up. Through all the times of despair and frustration, one of you has always been there to catch me when I fall. The injustice of this system has pierced my soul, yet each of you helped me to heal. Your belief and support helps me breathe life back into me when I feel like there is none left. There is a song by Celine Dion titled, "I'm Everything I Am Because You Love Me." I have sang this song for my precious baby boys. Now I want each of you to listen to the words of this song. This is what your love and support has done for me. To simply say thank you is not enough, and there really are no words to express the depth of my gratitude I feel for each of you. I know my boys are looking down from heaven with the same love and attitude for each of you. Through this fight, they will never be forgotten. I hope you believe in angels like I do and realize each one of you has two of the most precious angels watching over you as well. With love and prayers, Darlie Routier. Reading this makes me realize that she really was grieving and struggling and trying to be strong for her boys. I want to read one verse of the song she talked about. Celine Dion writes, quote, "Take me back in the arms I love, need me like you did before, touch me once again and remember when there was no one that you wanted more." This makes me think of her relationship with her sons, and it absolutely breaks my heart. Now, Alicia, I want to give you kind of one last go to kind of give your closing remarks, because you and I have different opinions on this case, but I think both opinions are very, very factually based, and I think that, you know, our listeners might have the same opinion. So I want to give you a chance to kind of quickly share your last thoughts.
This is what I think. I think that they still have one more boy's trial, period. Because they only tried her for one murder, right? I say bring her back and let her finish telling her story.
So do you think she did it?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. I think there's more to it. It's been how many years? Let's bring her back.
1996, mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that... Do you have any theories about what could have happened, or like alternate theories as to if she didn't do it, who did, or was she involved in this way, or was somebody else involved in this sort of capacity, anything like that?
I think that her husband is way more involved. I think that we're not hearing about him enough in all of this whole little story, and that he also needs to come in and tell his side of the story. I think there was a third person who was also involved, and I think that there's more. And I say there's still another boy's trial. He was also murdered. And let's go ahead and resolve it and bring them both back all these years later.
So you think there should be a retrial?
Not a retrial, but for the other boy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that Darren was way more involved than what people are, you know, saying. Because one thing that's bothered me, and it's bothered me since the beginning, is the fact that, you know, one thing I mentioned earlier is that Darlie said that she was saying Darren, and Darren said that she was saying Devin, and people kind of excused it because Darren was coming out of this, like, you know, cold sleep. Like, he was out cold. But here's my problem with that, is he wasn't out cold, because let's remember, Darren and Darlie were talking until about 1:30, and this whole thing happened around 2:30. So Darren was not even in REM yet. So I don't think Darren was in a cold sleep. And if he wasn't in a cold sleep, are you telling me that he didn't hear any of this? I don't know. There's a lot of questions that are unanswered. That's one thing I just wanted to, you know, point out, playing devil's advocate. But there are a lot of things that are unresolved. So, yeah, you're right. I agree with you.
Thanks, Justina.
Yeah. So let's, you know, Darlie's legal team is still fighting for justice. And there's a link on our website where you can write to Darlie or her defense team. We want to thank you guys for tuning in with us for our 10th episode. I worked so hard on this case, and I really hoped you guys enjoyed it. We will be posting our next episode on August 13th. Starting in September, we hope to be back to our regular bi-weekly schedule. I also want to let you guys know that you can support our show by going on our website. We really want to continue to grow our show and bring you guys good quality cases, so your support is greatly appreciated. Please be sure to give us a follow on Instagram at cracked.crime.podcast. You can also visit us on our website, which is linked in our bio. Feel free to send us an email with any case suggestions or questions regarding the case at crackedcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you guys so much, and be sure to join us next time for Cracked.